Some of my favorite stories, books, contain both prologue and epilogue. Okay? Prologues and epilogues as a means specifically of tying the story together. And my favorite books that don't have prologues and epilogues, I always kind of wish they did. You know, I always kind of come to the end and I wish there was something more. Something that took me a little bit deeper into the story. So what do I mean by that? Well, a prologue is an introduction, and this is something we talked about 65 weeks ago when we started John 1:1. Okay, a prologue is an introduction that typically shows the origins or beginnings of a story long before or at some point before the action of the story starts taking place. Okay, while the epilogue then gives us a glimpse of things that are happening as a result of the climax of the story. So the story's come to some form of resolution, and in the epilogue we see some things tied together a little bit, not giving us the answer to every single question, but some form of a satisfying end. So my favorite book, and of course to avoid controversy, I'm not putting the Bible in the same category as book for obvious reasons. Favorite book is Peace Like a River by Leif Anger, who's really my favorite modern author, by the way, because with most authors, you have to choose between either beautifully worded prose or like a page-turning, compelling nature to the story itself, right? So you're either reading the story and it's a page-turner and it's great, but the writing leaves a little something to be desired, or the writing's beautiful, but it's dense and, you know, you can only take so much of it at a time. But Leif Anger is one of those writers who does both really well. Beautiful prose, but a compelling story. And when I say Peace Like a River is my favorite book, I don't just mean it's my favorite novel. You know, I mean it's my favorite book. That's how good I think it is, so I think you should read it. And I won't ruin the story, but Peace Like a River, one of the things that for me makes it engaging is its use of first a prologue with the birth of the protagonist, the main character, years before the primary action of the narrative takes place. And then it ends with this satisfying epilogue after everything that's happened, not answering every question, but just enough for it to be truly satisfying at the end. Okay, so the other obvious one that comes to mind would be like Harry Potter, beginning with events before the action of the narrative, ending, I don't remember, like 20 years later, after the primary action is concluded. And so this combination, it can be so effective. This combination of prologue and epilogue is powerful because it balances out the events of the narrative. In other words, it allows for an author in the prologue to introduce certain themes, like dominant themes in his writing or in her writing that couldn't have been introduced right away otherwise. And then it allows that same author to return to that prologue. Like the themes get developed throughout the book, but then to return to it in a new way and show how powerful that is at the conclusion of the story. And John does exactly this as he's writing his gospel account. So if you remember, we started looking into the prologue, like I said, 65 weeks ago today, John 1:1, and we continued through that prologue. So John's prologue runs from verse 1 through verse 18. That took us a few weeks as we first started getting into John. And as a prologue, it begins the story long before the action of the story begins. Although I should say that with John's account, it's longer before the story begins than any other prologue I've ever read. Right? Because it starts in eternity past. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. In the beginning, with God, before space and time existed, the Word existed. And then that Word creates all things that are not Him. Everything that is not Him, He creates. And then His creation rebels against the Creator, and in order to come and save that creation, the Word becomes flesh, dwells among us, right? So what was the primary theme that we talked about in that prologue? We mentioned it several times along the way. What's the primary theme that John wants to address in this prologue? And a word that we kept returning to is revelation. God revealing Himself, showing Himself to us. And this is the theme that continued through John's gospel, John returns again and again, and now he returns here at the end in order to show it to us in a complete kind of way. In other words, here in the epilogue in 21, we get to come back to the same theme of Revelation, but we get to come back to it with a question. The question is, why does it matter? You know, so we just sang these words together, upon his grace I'll daily ponder and sing anew his praise. With all adoring wonder, his blessings I retrace. You know, like, we daily ponder upon his grace. We talk a lot about gospel remembrances at Gospel Life Church, like preaching the gospel to yourself daily, pondering on his grace daily. Why? Why? Well, because the gospel that the scriptures proclaim isn't it such good news? The gospel that the scriptures proclaim is not simply a consolation prize in the midst of our sin and suffering and death and chaos in this world. It's not like you got to put up with all this stuff, and so here's this consolation prize that I want to give you to make all that a little bit more tolerable. No, what we have in the gospel is a real answer to that, and not only so, but it's a life transformative gospel. It changes the way we live. It changes the way that we now set ourselves out as God's people, right? So, like, the gospel comes, and the revelation of God gives us faith and trust and salvation, right? But then it sets us off on mission. Like, it has everything to do with the life of the church. Why does it matter? Well, it matters a great deal, and we see that right away. Five parts of the narrative, five sections of the narrative, beginning in verse 1. Look there with me now. After this, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias, and he revealed himself in this way. Okay, so first of all, we see the setting designated. Okay, the setting designated because here, in these first couple of verses, Jesus reveals himself. He reveals himself. Right away in verse 1, John re-emphasizes the theme. After this, Jesus revealed himself. He uses a word that's striking. He reemphasizes the theme that began in the prologue and that continues through the account, and we're going to spend some time on that in a minute. So it's natural enough that John would begin a prologue with these words, after this, right? So he's given a purpose statement. It's almost seemed in some ways like the end of chapter 20 is a fitting conclusion for the book, but he wants to circle back again. So he says, after this. And you know, just like most prologues in the ancient Near East and actually prologues today, John doesn't seek to answer every question here. You know, like, we don't know everything. We don't know exact chronological details. All we see is the sequence of events. This happens at some point after the resurrection. The disciples have left Jerusalem. They've returned to Galilee. And you might remember that Jesus actually instructed the disciples to do just this in the Synoptic Gospels. So if you read places like Matthew 26, Jesus says to the disciples, after I am raised, I will go before you to Galilee. So they're starting to remember these things that Jesus said and instructed. So it's not necessarily remarkable that the disciples, suddenly we get to 21, the disciples are in Galilee. That's not necessarily remarkable. But what is remarkable is what happens in Galilee. And it's remarkable in a few different ways. The text says that there, by the Sea of Tiberias, that's it's another name for the Sea of Galilee that came about later, indicates that John's gospel was written later in the first century, okay? Which makes sense, well, we talked about it earlier. So Jesus, he revealed himself to the disciples here, at this place. And we see once again the self-revelation of the Word. God made flesh to reveal himself to us. The risen Christ now appearing before the disciples. And we can really trace this theme of revelation through John's gospel account. Because let's go back to it again. In the beginning was the Word. He came to his own. That Word came to his own. And his own people did not receive him. So he came. He revealed himself. His own people did not receive him. The Word became flesh, dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory. We've seen it. He revealed himself to us. That Word is nothing less than the revelation of God to humanity in the person of Jesus Christ. Okay, and then John continues in this theme. Just a handful of verses later, in chapter 1. Verse 31, John the Baptist cries out. He says, I myself did not know him, but for this purpose I came baptizing with water, that he might be revealed. Okay? That he might be revealed to Israel, to his people. Then we get to chapter 2. One chapter later, Jesus turns water into wine, and John concludes, this, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and revealed his glory. The word the ESV uses is manifested. It's the same Greek word as we see here in chapter 21. Okay, so revealed. He revealed himself. He revealed his glory. He performed this sign in order to reveal himself to us. Jesus directly tells us this. We're going to skip ahead a bit. John 17. He's praying. He says, I have revealed, ESV says manifested, same word though, I have revealed your name to the people whom you gave me out of the world. Those who have come to believe upon my name have done so because, why? They've seen and believed the revelation of God, the very revelation of God. I came to show myself to you. In other words, let me say it a different way. Jesus came to reveal himself to us, not to hide himself from us. Okay, and this is important. And you might hear that statement and it's like, well, obviously, you know. Obviously, he didn't want to hide himself. But no, listen. It's precisely what a good God would do. It's what a gracious God would do. And, you know, I really think this lends all kinds of credibility to John's gospel as being true. And it lends all kinds of credibility to the Christian faith as being true. Like, this serves as a powerful evidence for the reality of the Christian faith. And so what I mean is, so if you're here this morning and you're a skeptic of Christianity, you don't know what you believe, first of all, we want to say welcome to you. We want Gospel Life to be a place where you can learn and hear and ask questions, and we'd love to hear from you too. And as you explore Christianity, I've said this before, but I want to circle back to it a couple of times in the last 7 years, right? But there's a series of questions that you're faced with if you're going to reject Christianity. You know, you can't just, I mean, you can say, I'm going to explore Christianity and then not actually explore Christianity. That's true, you know. But you can't claim to be genuine in seeking out Christianity while at the same time not doing due diligence to reflect on these things, to ask yourself these questions. So first, let's just start here. Do you believe God exists? For the moment, let's not talk about God as we find him in the Bible. Let's just say a creator God. Do you believe God exists? The majority position throughout human history. And yeah, I would say on the basis of logic, reasoned argument, human experience, it's that God must exist. Like, there is a reason, friends. There's a reason that theism, belief in God, has been and continues to be the dominant position in the world. Throughout history, it's been the dominant position of philosophers, academics. It's been the dominant position of people across the globe. Why? Well, people have come to realize it takes even more faith to conclude that all of this in the world around us came about from nothing. The universe is somehow either eternal in both directions, without any kind of God, or just kind of erupted in a vacuum of nothingness, something came from nothing, than it is to believe in a creator who brought the world into existence, who allows for the world's continued existence. Like, arguments like the teleological argument says, okay, so here's in a nutshell, says that a world so complex, you know, with apparent design, would have to have a designer, and that teleological argument has been difficult to debunk over the centuries. Like, if sort of the historic way the argument's been put forward is, if we were to go for a hike together, we're in nature, we're in the backcountry, there's not a human in sight for miles, you know, a store, civilization. And on the path, we come across a wristwatch. You would not see that wristwatch and come to conclude that, wow, what a striking piece of nature this is. The waves on the shore must have just crashed at the precisely right time to then, over millions of years, fashion these gears in place, which then just remarkably fell in line with one another and in casings and wound. And not only so, but it seems to keep time, you know. It seems to have function. This is the basic level teleological argument. But okay, I'll go one a little bit higher. Okay, if you've ever been up to Lake Superior, go hiking on the Superior hiking trail or even just camping, you'll see stacks of smooth Superior rocks, right, that hikers have left behind. Some of them 1 foot, 2 feet, stacks of rocks, right? And none of us would even see that and come to conclude from it, I bet those rocks just fell one on top of the other as waves came crashing onto shore. None of us would do that. All of us would see this, and we would realize this is a sign that a hiker's been here before, that they've stacked these up. And friends, this world in which we live is so much more complex, like infinitely more complex than a wristwatch, which is infinitely more complex than a stack of rocks, right? And this is what makes fine-tuning arguments like the ones put forward by men like William Lane Craig so convincing. And if you have questions about that or like you want to get your hands on well-reasoned arguments like that, I'd love to put material in your hands. I mean, all of this is what leads men like Notre Dame philosopher Alvin Plantinga to go so far as to say the belief in God is a properly basic belief. He says theism is properly basic, and what he means by that is inwardly we know it to be true. Okay, so let's say you conclude, all right, along with the majority of human history, along with the majority of the globe now, I'll say a God exists. All right. Second question, is he good? Does God exist? Yes. Is he good? Well, Anselm, in his ontological argument, clears this up nicely for us by saying that if God exists, that God, if he exists, must be something that which nothing greater could be conceived. Like nothing greater than him could possibly even be thought of, because if something greater than him could be conceived, then he's not all powerful, he's not all great. So if you could conceive of an all-powerful, good, loving God, morally perfect, that would certainly be greater than an evil, impetuous God. There's a reason why the gods of Greek mythology really never got off the ground, right? Like, the gods of Greek mythology who throw temper tantrums and are more easily characterized by the failures of human nature. Why? Because they remind us of us. I can conceive of a God greater than that, and if I can conceive in my mind of a God greater than that, how can we call them God? No, a truly all-powerful being would not be constrained by the same failings as humans. He would have to be morally perfect to be the greatest conceivable being. Otherwise, we could conceive of something greater. He wouldn't be God. So, okay, I think does God exist? Yes. I think we're on good grounds to say if he exists, is he good? Yes. Third question, would a good God reveal himself or would he stay hidden? And you know, so when I say Jesus came, we see in John's account, Jesus came to reveal himself to us, not to hide himself from us, and we say, well, obviously. Well, okay, listen, there's a view called deism that believes that there's actually a lot of forms of this. It is a very popular expression of religion that believes that, yeah, sure, there's a creator God. He just kind of wound the world up. He created it, and then he let it go, and then he stepped back, and he just doesn't engage. We have to ask, and that's very different from John's account. We have to ask, is that what a good God would do? And this is where we really see the power in John's account, because that's precisely what John said God set out to do from eternity past. Like, it's what his prologue's about. It's what his epilogue's about. He was never planning on hiding himself from his people. Never. So what of it? Is this consistent? Would a good God reveal himself rather than hide himself? And I think a more than reasonable conclusion would be that if God were good, which he must be, he would not leave humanity to toil and struggle without hope or knowledge of who he really is and what he's come to do. He wouldn't leave humanity guessing and raging against one another while just being quiet in the heavenlies. Which leads us to the fourth question that I think a reasonable person can conclude. God exists. That God is good. He's therefore a God who would reveal himself. So the natural question is, where has he revealed himself? And I would contend that we see it squarely in the person of Jesus Christ. And I would also contend that from the good news at the center of it to its explanation of the world around us being so spot on, human nature, sin and suffering and death and chaos, where it all came from, right? Okay, to the amount of historical evidences we have for the miracle at the very center of it, the scriptures are God's revelation to us. And so, I would encourage you, if you're spiritually seeking, if you're here this morning and you're spiritually seeking, read the scriptures. Come here, we'll read them together. Read the scriptures on your own. Come, ask questions. Because here we see the setting designated. Like, Jesus came, he designated this specific time to reveal himself to us. And he's designated the word as the means by which he reveals himself to us now. This is actually what this text is about, and we'll see it even more clearly over the next 2 weeks. So it's here that we see, okay, the scene described. So we go from the setting designated now to the scene described because the disciples are waiting on the lake. Look at verses 2 to 3. Simon Peter called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples were together. So there's seven disciples together. Simon Peter said to them, I'm going fishing. They said to him, we will go with you. They went out and got into the boat. But that night, they caught nothing. Very quickly, the scene unfolding here is that these seven disciples are waiting for Jesus in Galilee. Simon Peter's mentioned first, probably for a couple of reasons. Number one, he's kind of the unofficial leader, and that's evidenced by the fact that he's the one who says, I'm going to go fishing. And they all say, we'll go with you. Okay? But there's another reason why he's mentioned, and we're going to see that come to bear over the next couple of weeks. This chapter, in a unique kind of way, is drawing Peter. Jesus is drawing Peter out. All right? Now, a couple of quick thoughts here. So they're fishing and waiting. First, while there are several commentators that are in the habit of villainizing the disciples for going fishing, I don't think it's entirely fair or accurate or necessary. You know, like, there's something to it, but just hear me out. And listen, the commentaries that don't like that they went fishing, they really don't like that they went fishing. They don't mince words. One says, he says, the scene is one of complete apostasy. I mean, I think there are scenes in the scriptures of complete apostasy. This doesn't strike me as one. Okay. Another says, he says, it's unthinkable that Peter and his brother disciples should contemplate a return to their former occupation after the events of chapter 20. Sorry, I'm giving these comments a little bit of tone. All right. A third describes it as aimless activity undertaken by desperation. Now listen, if you're a fisherman like me, you're used to the hate, right? I get it. I see you. You're used to people thinking this is the hobby of the lazy and the forlorn. It's not the case, right? We get it. So I don't think this is true. Not entirely so. I don't think we have any good reason to, like, heap large amounts of blame on them. I would agree with F.F. Bruce, who says, look, there's no evidence in the text to show Peter abandoning his commission by going fishing. And then George Beasley Murray just nails it very practically. He says, even though Jesus be crucified and risen from the dead, the disciples still must eat, you know? They still got to eat. They still got to provide for their families. So it's hard to conclude from the text that there's a ton of blame. At the same time, let's see it from the other side a little bit. Now, I'm not going to go as far as to call this complete apostasy, but listen. It's clear by what unfolds in 20 and then into 21. The disciples are not yet driven by a spirit-filled mission to spread the gospel. What we see here isn't quite what we'll see in Acts, you know, when Pentecost happens, and that's okay, right? So that will come. But it's easy to wonder here whether John's use of night, just to remind you again, his use of night at the end of verse 3, Simon Peter said to them, I'm going fishing. They said to him, we will go with you. They went out, got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. And we talked about how whenever John uses this word, or at least in a few other instances, whether it's darkness or night, he's drawing out, yes, a historical detail, but also he's giving some theological context to it as well, okay? And it's easy to wonder whether or not that's the case here. You know, Nicodemus visits Jesus by night, shows that his heart's dark, darker than he knows. Judas goes out by night. The disciples are fishing by night. But I do think, listen, if this is the case, the thrust is likely very different. So it's not showing their foolish hearts are darkened, right? So much as it's showing like a lack of understanding. Like, this is a teaching opportunity that Jesus is going to take full advantage of, you know? So it's a teaching opportunity. Their understanding is still darkened, right? They're not yet driven by Spirit-filled mission to spread the gospel. And Jesus is going to shine some light on this. So as Carson writes, Carson says, they are coming to grips with the resurrection, but they still have not learned the profound truth that apart from Christ, they can do nothing, right? Jesus says that, abide in me, you know, I'm the vine, abide in me, apart from me, you can do nothing. Apart from Christ, they can do nothing, and so they caught nothing, right? There's this corollary here. Jesus desires to show them, especially Peter, something of the reality of Christ-centered dependency, which we'll see in even more detail over the next couple of weeks. So, okay, we've seen the setting designated, the theme here related to the revelation of Jesus. Then the scene described, the seven disciples fishing, waiting by night. Now we see the sign declared. Thirdly, the sign declared because there's this overwhelming catch. Look at verses 4-6. Just as the day was breaking, Jesus stood on the shore, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to them, "Children, do you have any fish?" They answered him, "No." He said to them, "Cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some." So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because of the quantity of fish. So much like what we saw with Mary Magdalene on Easter morning together, we can't be sure if the disciples, if the reason they don't recognize Jesus is because their eyes are being kind of kept from seeing, like the disciples on the road to Emmaus, or if this is sort of like what I would say was happening with Mary, whether it's distance, like he's too far away, or that, and I think very probably, there's some sense in which they're not expecting to see him, even though they know at this point that he's risen. They're still, you know, for I think understandable reasons, this is a lot to process, okay? So they're still not expecting this. And I think that's probably right, but in any case, Jesus engages them, and it's here that we really see a constant reality of Jesus' self-revelation. There's something that's constant about any time Jesus reveals himself, and the constant reality is he reveals himself on his own terms and not on the disciples' terms. Like, he's the one who initiates. He's the one who goes to them. He's the one who shows himself to them. They don't go to him. They can't conjure him. Right? There isn't some kind of like the disciples can't gather together in a circle, take hands, and chant something in order to, for Jesus to then be conjured. And that kind of reminds me of Narnia, where the enemies of Aslan, you know, the white witch, the demonic realm, they can be conjured. They're conjured in Prince Caspian. You can conjure the dark realm, but you can't conjure Aslan, you know. He's not a tame lion. He doesn't just come when he's called. He determines when and where he reveals himself. He comes on his own time, and his own time is always correct. And so Jesus comes on his own terms, he engages them, children. Term of endearment. Do you have any fish? Their quick no, without any elaboration at all, might indicate some fatigue, you're tired, some annoyance. Like, when you're not catching a lot, it's like when the Bears are getting blown out 45-3 and the third person in a row sticks their head in the room and they ask me, "Hey, what's the score?" You know, it's like, I don't want to talk about it, frankly. That might be how they're feeling. I don't want to talk about it. Like, did you catch any fish? I don't know. You know, so some fatigue, perhaps some annoyance, all right? He says, cast the net on the on the right side of the boat, and you'll find something that's interesting because, so the right side in the Greek-speaking world of the ancient Near East, the right side was affiliated with, like, luck. It wouldn't have been necessarily advice anyone would have been surprised to hear. And so it's interesting wondering what the, and it's speculation, right? So it's just wondering how the disciples are processing this. Some fisherman, lone fisherman on the shore, calling back out to them, have you tried the right side of the boat? But they, despite the fact they haven't recognized Jesus, they humor this apparent stranger. And that's also interesting because this has happened with Jesus at the front end of their call to follow him. This happened already. Not in John's account. The details are different, but earlier in the synoptic accounts, Jesus commands the same thing with a similar, but not identical outcome. Similar, not identical command, right? So it's like some have speculated, well, John is misplacing, like it's the same story, but John's putting it at a different spot, either for a literary technique or John is just wrong about when it happened or there's disagreement about when it happened. But I don't think so. I don't think that's the case at all. I think this is a completely different event. And I think this for a few different reasons. What I think John is doing here very likely is, so he's writing his account last, almost certainly. He's writing his account last. He's drawing on a well-known account of Jesus doing this very thing when he called them. At the front end, most believers are going to know that story. And the fact that this is also, we're going to see it, we're going to see it next week, we're going to see it the week after, we see it this morning, it's tied to mission, the mission of the church. And what was Jesus doing when this initial miracle took place? He was calling the disciples initially to mission, like, I will make you fishers of men, right? Like, follow me. Words that we're going to hear again over the next 2 weeks, right? So what I think John's doing is writing his account last, drawing on the well-known story, and sharing this new historical detail in light of that. And I think what Jesus is doing is connecting them back again with his first call of them. He wants them to remember. Like, there's a lot of that here in John 21. He wants them to remember. I think we'll see it even more, again, following 2 weeks. So hang in there. In any case, they don't recognize him, but maybe they shrug their shoulders, being tired of not catching anything. It certainly couldn't hurt. They're not catching anything over here. So let's just do it. Maybe this guy will stop asking us questions about fish. Suddenly their net is so full of fish they can't even pull it into the boat. Different than Luke's account where two boats in danger of sinking, right? So I think this is a different event. In any case, John writes at the end of 20, Jesus did even more amazing signs, right? But now in 21, he gives us another one before he's done. The resurrected Christ showing his power for the disciples, even at this moment where they're confused, even when they're so unsure of what to do next, even though it's true that they don't have this sense of like spirit-filled mission, they're confused about what to do next, like even in the midst of that, Jesus comes and he shows his power by grace, he initiates, he engages. And this leads us from the sign declared to now the surprised disciples, verses 7 through 8. That disciple whom Jesus loved, John, therefore said to Peter, it is the Lord. Which is interesting too, right? Because in chapter 20, John's the one who believes in the empty, at the empty tomb. Peter's still, right? So there, another dynamic like that. John is the first to recognize it is the Lord. When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he stood for work, and threw himself into the sea. So John was the one who believed. Peter was the one that charged past him into the tomb, right? Remember? So we see these things consistent throughout John's account. It's very interesting, and I think lends credibility to the eyewitness testimony aspect of this gospel account. Okay, so the other disciples, so he put on his outer garment, he was stripped for work, threw himself into the sea. The other disciples came into the boat, dragging the net full of fish, for they were not far from the land, about 100 yards off. Once again, we see evidence of Peter's apparent boldness. And I said we'd get here again in 21. It's not out of character. Peter's the one who routinely he's the one who speaks up. Even in the synoptics, right? Like, you are the Christ. Like, Peter's the one who jumps out with his knife to confront Jewish authorities. He's the one who immediately throws himself in to swim to shore. And verse 8, I read as kind of humorous because I think it's evidence that this is being written from an eyewitness on the boat, John. Because rather than, the narrative doesn't followed Peter's swim to shore and the beach. The narrative follows now the disciples having to get all this stuff back to land with one less person's help, you know? And so I think to a certain extent, it's meant to be read that way. It's like impetuous Peter once again boldly throwing himself into something without thinking of the consequences for others. I mean, read it again. The other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish, about 100 yards off. Thanks, Peter. Right. And of course, Peter's throwing himself into the water, swimming to Jesus, does show a certain excitement mixed with perhaps anxiety about the conversation he knows he's going to have here. This is a very emotional moment, one that we'll draw upon for the next 2 weeks, okay? So, it's amplified even more, finally, then, in, we'll call it the stage determined, because here we'll see the scene set for the next couple of weeks. It's the stage determined. This is a place for grace, this breakfast with the disciples. So look at verses 9 through 14. When they got out on land, they saw a charcoal fire in place with a fish laid out on it and bread. Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish that you've just caught. So Simon Peter went aboard and hauled the net ashore full of large fish, 153 of them. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. Perhaps a second miracle? Okay? Jesus said to them, come and have breakfast. Now none of the disciples dared ask him, who are you? They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and so with the fish. This was now the third time that Jesus was revealed to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. So here we see the multiple ways that Jesus' revelation, like disclosing himself to us, showing himself to us, sets the stage for grace. Because first, and mission, and sends us out on mission. Why? Well, first, note this charcoal fire. We're going to talk about it next week. The only other place this term was used in John's gospel, as we already discussed, was chapter 18, where Peter was warming himself by a charcoal fire outside of where Jesus was being held and questioned. And around that charcoal fire, he denies Jesus three times. Charcoal fires, you know, I think this is the intent. Charcoal fires have a very specific feel and smell, right? Different fires have different smells. And you know, certain smells, they not only serve to identify what it is that we're smelling, but they bring back memory. They're attached to memory. You know, like whenever I smell leaves burning, I love that smell, you know, because in Northern Illinois, whenever I was headed out to see my friends who lived in Kirkland, you know, or we were going out to the apple orchard in the fall, people were always raking and burning leaves. And it's just, it reminds me of my childhood. I really love that smell. And every time, like, memories come flooding back. And honestly, I really do think we're meant to imagine Peter here, flooded with the shame and memory of the charcoal fire in chapter 18, now standing before Jesus, eager with his own anxiety to speak with him. And it's in the midst of this, the disciples with Peter pull the fish in, 153 of them, to shore. And just to say, I'm not going to elaborate here, there's an abundance of theories as to what 153 means. None of them really helpful at all, because all of them, from my perspective, are wildly speculative. All right? 1 plus 5 plus 3 equals this number, which must be referring to this thing. 1 times 5 times 3. This is like the mark of the beast in, you know, in John 21, that we're meant to somehow like come up with these wild and elaborate things on the basis of these numbers when there's no evidence for the text. Then any connection that these theories draw, like, oh, it's referring to Ezekiel along with like Josephus talks about 153 species of fish, but he doesn't. Okay, and all these things, and it connects back to mission in that way. It's such a small thread of connection. So, like, I'll put forward my hopefully non-speculative theory. I think John lists this number, 153 here, because that's how many fish there were. Okay? And I think that's how we say, honestly, we need to read our Bibles that way unless we have a very clear explanation giving us a contrary reason. All right, okay. That's how many fish there are. In Zechariah's vision, do you remember Zechariah chose those specific colors for the horses? You know, red, brown, because that's what color the horses were. That was my opinion. In any case, Jesus takes from the catch. He invites the disciples to breakfast. The fact that he issues an invitation in this moment is another evidence that he comes in grace and mercy. Because, look, think about what's happening here. This is a lot like chapter 20. The fact that he's issuing an invitation in the midst of doubt. Right? You had doubting Thomas, super hesitant to believe anything, not wanting to believe anything without touching and feeling, and yet Jesus doesn't leave him in his doubt, but he issues an invitation. Come, feel it. We talked about this last week. The way that Jesus deals with doubt is to confront it with mercy and grace. He doesn't rebuke, he invites. And that's what we see him doing here too. Like, the disciples are super hesitant to approach, hesitant to talk, except for Peter, hesitant to talk, hesitant to share their doubts, hesitant to ask what's on their mind. They want to ask, who are you? But they also know who it is, right? So they're hesitant. They doubt even after the resurrection. And you know, it's easy to think of a rebuke here. It's like, if you don't believe now, I'm risen from the dead. Like, if you don't believe now, what else do you need? Jesus doesn't do that. What does he say? Come have breakfast with me. You know, like, invitation, love, grace, truth. He draws them to himself. And we'll see in weeks forward this reality that I believe to be at the center of our text. And it's this. The revelation of Jesus is the revelation of grace to the believer. The revelation of Jesus is a revelation of grace to the believer. And that revelation of grace to the believer then sets the believer out in a spirit-filled mission, in a different kind of living. Like, it's revelation that doesn't seek to primarily harshly condemn. The world is condemned already. Judgment is due already. But rather, it primarily sets out to graciously invite, to draw us in by grace and kindness into what Christ has done by faith, that we might have life. This is where I found this week. Here's a good place to sum up. Grant Osborne writes this quote. He says, when we submit and obey, even when it seems illogical, you know, like, and there are many times in which in the church we are called to submit and obey to what Jesus tells us to do in ministry in ways that seem logical to us. Like, the center of our ministry is like preaching. That doesn't seem like it's going to do much, like proclaiming word-centeredness. Shouldn't it be entertainment? Shouldn't it be something more cutting edge and viable in a cultural moment, right? But like, so it seems illogical. But when we submit and obey, even when it seems illogical, miraculous things will happen. Christ is in charge of each of our ministries, and we are to surrender to his power and leading in all that we do. What we attempt in our own strength, the night of fishing, will often be discouraging, but when we allow Christ to be in charge, casting their nets on the other side of the boat, there will be wondrous results. The breakfast scene turns this emphasis around to show, as the church engages in mission, we are assured that the risen Lord himself is watching over us and caring for our every need. He's caring for our every need. So hear this. A good God exists. He's revealed himself in Christ. He's given us his written word that we might know him, believe him, follow him, and proclaim him to the world around us. And friends, like, if you hear that and you think, but I'm not good enough to follow. I can't do that. I can't obey. You're right. It's grace. Throw yourself on his mercies because, as we sang a moment ago, all the fitness he requires is to feel your need of him. To see that you can't, and then to trust that he can. And so we trust in him together with the mission of GLC. Let's look to him in prayer. God, we're grateful. We daily ponder this gospel. We sing anew your praise. We retrace your blessings because, Lord, you did not give us a mere consolation prize. You gave us good news of life that begins now and goes on for all eternity and that we'll be celebrating forever in your presence. So what we ask for now, God, is faith, to throw ourselves upon your mercies, to believe that you can do what we can't do for ourselves, dependency on you as we move forward in mission, and we pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.